And so we're going to look at some passages here in our section on angels and demons, part 4, angels and demons, part 4. And again, these notes are very simple. I've put the text here, but we will chase down some other scripture references as well. One of the things that you'll notice when you're looking at the subject of demons in particular, and I'll use the term demons, evil spirits, deceiving spirits. I mean, I'll use some of these terms interchangeably because that's how the Bible uses them. One of the things that you learn is that when you study demons, when you study demonology, is you realize that they're basically classified into two groups, that you have demons that are free and you have demons that are in prison. Now, this raises a big question. Why are some incarcerated, right? Why are they bound? You know, what did they do that would bring about their being locked up? Because they were exceptionally bad in some ways. And so, Peter, in his first letter, his first epistle, talks about angels who are now in prison. In fact, go with me over to 1 Peter 3:19. Because one of the things that you'll see, and I'm actually, I guess, going to kind of chase a rabbit trail here for a second, because I'm going to kind of set the stage for where we're going to be next week in anticipation. Peter talks about these spirits, these angels, these demons, which are in prison. Now, in 1 Peter 3:19, he talks about Christ. And it talks about how Christ went and made proclamation to the spirits, this would be angelic beings, to the spirits now in prison. And this proclamation could almost be taken like a victory proclamation. But it raises the question to the spirits that are now in prison. Why are these spirits in prison? Or verse 20, he talks about how these spirits were once disobedient. Well, disobedient in the original fall or disobedient at some other time? This in the context, it has to be at some other time other than the fall. He says, who once were disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah. In the days of Noah. So there's some activity that these spirit beings engaged in that was pretty bad. And it took place in the days of Noah, during the construction of the ark, that is, in which 8 persons were brought safely through the water, that is, through the flood. Now, Peter doesn't unpack it. He just simply tells us that Jesus went and made proclamation to these spirits, these fallen angels that are now in prison, who were disobedient in the days of Noah. He doesn't tell us what their sin was, except that they were disobedient at this time frame in history. Now, in his second epistle, 2 Peter 2:4, 2 Peter 2:4, he says, "For if God did not spare angels," now these are fallen angels, "if God did not spare angels when they sinned." And again, you have to ask, well, what kind of sin are we talking about? He doesn't say. But it says, "but cast them into hell." Now, hell is not a very good translation. The Holman Christian Standard Bible renders the word hell here from the Greek word Tartarus, which is a better rendering of the word here from the Greek. "But cast them into Tartarus and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment." So again, you have these angels who sinned. They did some bad thing. They committed a no-no in the eyes of God. And they had to be placed in these pits of darkness reserved for judgment. And he gives us the context of it again, verse 5, "and did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah." So this is the second time he talks about these angels that sinned in the days of Noah. And so again, it just kind of piques your curiosity, doesn't it? And then Jude, over in the book of Jude, find Revelation and go back a few pages. And Jude is only one chapter, but Jude chapter 1, verse 6 and 7. Now Jude here kind of hints at the kind of sin that they committed. In Jude 1, 6, it says, "And angels who did not keep their own domain." Now the domain here, I think he's talking about the domain in the unseen realm. I think that's what he's talking about. I think they stepped out of bounds, as it were. And angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under the darkness for the judgment of the great day. Now, anytime you see the judgment of the great day, that's going to be an allusion to the tribulation. But notice at the end of verse 6, there's a comma, which means that the thought is not concluded. So whatever these angels did when they left their domain, when they abandoned their proper abode, he goes on in verse 7, "Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way as these," since they, that would be the Sodomites of Sodom and Gomorrah, "in the same way as these," that would be the angels, "indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire." Now that would again seem to imply that there was something that these angels did by leaving their domain and going after strange flesh. Again, it would seem to imply that there's a sexual connotation of what's going on here. But the point is, just the larger picture of what I'm getting at here, is that what we see is that we have a group of angels that are incarcerated. They're a pretty bad lot of angels. And personally, I think if you go back to Genesis 6, I'll go back there now, we'll chase this again, we'll hit this again, I'll unpack this a little more in the days ahead. But when you're looking at Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, you have this account of why God brought the flood upon the earth. In Genesis 6, 1, it says, "Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born to them." Then you have the phrase in verse 2, "that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose." Sons of God, that Hebrew phrase, B'nai Elohim, occurs in Job 1:6, it occurs in Job 2:1, and it occurs in Job 38:7. In all three references, it refers to angels. Now, this raises some pretty serious questions. Because it says that these sons of God, these B'nai Elohim, saw the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. "Then the Lord said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. Then he says, verse 4, "The Nephilim," these giants, "were on the earth in those days. And also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, these were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown." Verse 5, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Now, the thought is that behind this verse, behind this section here, is that you have this reference to the sons of God, these B'nai Elohim, who appear from other references of Scripture to be fallen angels, who are coming down and who are cohabiting with these women and producing these offspring that appear to be not fully human. Now the question is, why would they do that? What's the point of that? Remember back in Genesis 3:15, God had promised Eve that one of her seed would crush the head of the serpent. And the argument of reasoning goes like this, that Satan thought that if he could infiltrate the human race and somehow modify it genetically so that it's something other than fully human, then he could prevent Genesis 3:15 from happening. Because if you can modify the human race genetically so that it's not truly human, then you cannot have a true descendant of Eve come into existence. You cannot have it's an attack upon Christ, is what it becomes. Now, the theological camp is literally divided down the middle. I mean, great theologians that I love and admire reject that view. They argue that the sons of God are descendants of Seth, mentioned in the genealogy prior to that. But there's reasons why I don't think that's the best understanding of the text. But Genesis 6 is probably one of the most hotly debated passages in all of the Bible. What do you do with it? And if you say that the sons of God here refers to the line of Seth, that it's just a human line, that basically what you have is believers marrying unbelievers, that's the big sin, okay? Then how do you explain these fallen angels in Peter and Jude that are locked up? Why are they locked up? Why are they in prison? And why does Peter twice reference these angels that are in prison back to the days of Noah? That would seem to imply that whatever happened here in Genesis 6 is what Peter is alluding to, because he references it back to the days of Noah. And in Jude 1, 6, and 7, Jude seems to hint that it had something to do with going after strange flesh, that there was some sexual immorality going on there. And so he kind of hints at the kind of sin that they committed, but he also talks about them being in prison. And that would explain that basically God had to remove these angels and say, you're just too bad. You're just causing too much trouble, and I have to put you in prison. Now, they're going to be released. It appears that these are the fallen angels that are currently incarcerated and will be released at a future time. In fact, over in Revelation chapter 9, if you'll go with me over there, Revelation chapter 9, it says here in verse 1, "Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. And he opened the bottomless pit, the abyss, and smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke." And so out comes these demonic hordes, which are able to go forth and to inflict pain. You get down into verses 13 through 15, and you have another set of angels. Verse 13, it says, "Then the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, one saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, 'Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates.'" Well, isn't that interesting? So here we have a spiritual prison located on the earth somewhere near the Euphrates River, right? But during the tribulation, these demons that are in this supermax prison, as it were, are going to be released. And it says in verse 15, "And the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released, so that they would kill a third of mankind." Well, that's pretty bad. that you have these four angels that are, again, in this supermax prison. And again, you have to ask the question, why are they there? You know? Now, in just the large picture, what we know is that demons fit into two categories, that you have demons that are free and you have demons that are incarcerated. And then, of course, you begin to ask the question, why? Why are they locked up? You know, what was their sin that they committed? And when you look at the two references in Peter and the reference in Jude, and the both referring back to the days of Noah and going after strange flesh, it would seem to explain Genesis 6 in that context, especially linguistically with the argument of the B'nai Ha, or the B'nai Elohim, the sons of God, as it's used elsewhere with reference to angels. So, again, that's possible. Can one be dogmatic on that? The answer is no, you can't. I think the argument is in favor of that, but then it raises all sorts of questions. Well, what do you do when it says that angels don't marry? Well, when you look in the Bible presents angels strictly in masculine terms. So they don't marry because there's no female angels, there's no little baby angels running around. So they don't marry and they don't reproduce after their own kind. But then it raises questions, well, you know, could they take on human form? And clearly angels can eat. In fact, when you look at Genesis chapter 18 and 19, you have two angels that are with Christ in pre-incarnate form that appear to Abraham, and they sit down to have a meal with him. And then these two angels leave Abraham, go down to Sodom, but when they appear to Lot down in Sodom, they appear as men, they appear as people. And so you have, apparently, angels are able to take on human form. Apparently, they can eat a meal. Apparently, they can look like just a normal person. In fact, some have entertained angels unaware, right? So you wouldn't know. I even look like a hippie wearing flip-flops or some guy in a business suit or something. I don't know. But whatever form they take, they look like everybody. They look like any normal person. So if they could take on human form such that they're not distinguishable from a person, what then becomes their capability? How far can they go? And could they copulate? Could there be some reproduction going on? Again, raises big questions. We don't know. Can't be dogmatic. But I leave you with those thoughts. Now, going on in the notes here, apparently demons have some freedom, and they are, to some degree, permitted to defy God, albeit in a limited way. Satan provides a good example of this, a one who operates by the boundaries that God has established. Go with me over to Job chapter 1. So Satan, it's not a free-for-all. Satan is not free to just run about and do whatever Satan pleases. Always keep in mind the sovereignty of God. Always keep in mind the sovereignty of God when you think about satanic or demonic activity. And this is a good example here. So in Job chapter 1, verse 6, now there was a day when the B'nai Elohim came to present themselves before the Lord, and Hashatan also came among them. Hashatan, the adversary, the Satan. He's called the Satan. And so he comes among them. So clearly we have a heavenly scene where the B'nai Elohim refers to angels that come into the presence of God, and Satan also came among them. And then the Lord engages Satan. He questions him. He says, "Where do you come from?" And Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." So he's been out and about. Maybe he's been on vacation, been down in the Bahamas for a little while, and decided to go visit Texas. And then, we weren't a state back then, but you get the point. He's walking around on the earth. He's checking things out. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Now notice now, God is the one that initiates the conversation about Job here. "Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, fearing God and turning away from evil." And Satan challenges him. Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Does Job fear God? In other words, He's a righteous man. He turns away, but you protected him. Notice what he says, verse 10. Have you not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Here's the challenge. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. In other words, the challenge is, yeah, Job serves you, yeah, Job worships you, yeah, Job blesses you, but that's only because you've blessed him and you put a hedge about him and I can't touch him. But he says, but touch all that he has and he will surely curse you to your face. Now, does Satan know human nature? Does he understand human psychology? And the answer to that is very much so, yes. But notice what comes back in verse 12. Then the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him. So Satan comes after Job only because God permitted it. But he's not allowed to touch Job. Notice there's a restraint. In other words, he says, you can touch all that he has, but you can't touch him. So here we see the divine restraint upon Satan. And then we read on there about how Job's family was killed, how his business was destroyed. And Job recognizes this. Job 1:20, then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head, and he fell to the ground and he worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Now, Satan may have been the instrument, the agent that came and brought these things about. And his attempt was to try to get Job to curse God, and Job didn't do that. In the very last clause, it says in verse 22, through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Isn't that interesting? And so, but he says, I mean, he recognizes the sovereignty of God. Then Satan comes back in chapter 2, verses 1 through 6, and he says, hey, yeah, I misread him the first time around. Yeah, he stayed the course. But touch his flesh. Right? Verse 4, Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. So again, the Lord said to Satan, behold, he's in your power, only spare his life. So now you can go after him and cause physical malady, but you can't kill him. So again, he puts a restraint on him. So the point is that when you're thinking about demonic activity, whether it's Satan or one of his minions, you have to realize that they are always under God's sovereign control, either in this case to permit, and God clearly establishes boundaries for these fallen angels. Now what becomes interesting, and we might say that that's the permissive will of God, that God is permitting these things to happen. Now what's interesting is that God sometimes used evil spirits to accomplish his sovereign purposes. In the book of Judges, we learn about a man named Abimelech who killed his 70 brothers in order to remove competition to his being a leader. And this was permitted to happen. He was allowed to kill his 70 brothers. That he might gain a position of political power in the land. Abimelech's a bad guy. And the text tells us that 3 years after his crime, that God judged Abimelech. And the text tells us that he used an evil spirit to accomplish his purposes. Judges 9:23 and 24 tells us God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, so that the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. And so this evil spirit comes in and causes this discord among Abimelech and the men of Shechem. Verse 4, so that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might come, and their blood might be laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. So basically, the evil spirit comes in and turns them on each other. They work together for a time that the men of Shechem basically agreed with Abimelech to kill his brothers. But now this evil spirit comes in and basically they turn on each other. And this becomes a means by which God is bringing about judgment. Basically, they turn on each other. But this evil spirit, and again, we're not given the particulars, but the evil spirit was used to that end. And it just shows, it just gives an example of how God judges some situations and how an evil spirit might be used to that end. On another occasion, when King Saul turned away from walking with God, the Lord sent an evil spirit to cause him trouble. 1 Samuel 16, verses 14 and 15 says, "Now the Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. And Saul's servants then said, 'Behold now, an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you.'" So apparently they knew it as well. Now, how did they know that? And the text doesn't tell us, except that this demon, this evil spirit, was sent to terrorize King Saul because of his disobedience. And sometimes this same evil spirit caused psychosis, that is, madness, which led to Saul's murderous behavior. And we have an example in the scriptures here where twice King Saul tried to kill David. This is one of those interesting things where you have somebody who is, I don't believe he was demon-possessed, we might say he was demonized, he was under the influence of an evil spirit, but it created this hostility that Saul had toward David, and very much wanted to kill David. And so in this text here, notice in the notes, and here I'm reading from 1 Samuel 18, 10 through 12. "Now it came about on the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul, and he raved in the midst of the house." So, again, it's causing Saul a great deal of mental distress. Again, this psychosis that he's going to rave in the house. And it says here, "While David was playing the harp with his hand, as usual," it says, "and a spear was in Saul's hand. And Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, 'I will pin David to the wall.' But David escaped from his presence," what? "Twice." And then it says, "Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul." So Saul's, this evil spirit, again, it created a madness within Saul, in which he hated David, tried to kill him twice, but then he also feared David. Two mental attitude sins, one of hatred and one of fear. And again, this is brought on by this evil spirit that is causing this in Saul, who has turned away from the Lord. He has broken away from the Lord, and so he's put himself in a position of coming under divine discipline, and that God is using this evil spirit for that end. Now, when I was growing up as a boy, again in the Pentecostal church, that way of thinking, of understanding God's sovereignty and even using evil spirits to that end, that was just something that was just, you never heard that. You would have never heard that. In fact, you would have heard just the opposite, that God never does that. But again, when you go through and you understand the sovereignty of God, that God is in absolute, complete control, and either he's allowing situations to happen or he's directing situations to happen, all of life is under his control. All of life. And David was the unfortunate recipient of Paul's madness, of Saul's madness. And David fled for his life. In fact, it's interesting that you read the account here, and we're about to read it in just a minute, I didn't put it in there, but it's in the text where when David flees, His wife has to help him escape through a window to get away from Saul. And so David has to employ normal means of trying to escape and hide because Saul's trying to kill him. Now listen, God could stop this. God could stop this, but I believe that David's being called to serve as Israel's king required David to go through some years of humbling and some years of training. And David fled from Saul. I believe it was 7 years. David had to hide out in the wilderness. And you read about his wilderness wanderings where he's fleeing from Saul. And Saul's on the hunt. Saul's out trying to kill him. And David displays himself to be the noble man because he's in that moment where he's in the cave and Saul goes in there to relieve himself. And David sneaks up and David could have done him in. And he cuts off a piece of his robe to demonstrate that, look, you were within my reach. I could have killed you, but I didn't because I don't hate you. I'm not that kind of person. And then at another time, he's in the camp, Saul is sleeping, and he has an opportunity. And even his one of his soldiers tells him, look, just kill him. He's right here. You could put an end to this whole wilderness wandering charade. We could put all this to an end right now. David says, I will not strike the Lord's anointed. Because God had to bring about Saul's removal in God's time and God's way. And he gave Saul. And see, this is one of those interesting points about God's grace. Because just because somebody is a believer, and I believe that Saul was a believer for the years that he was on the throne, for the decades that he was on the throne, and he turned away from the Lord, but God did not remove him from the position of power, and God continued to provide for him, just like he did for the Israelites in the wilderness. Remember, they came out of Egypt, and they were 11 days' journey from going into the land, and test after test after test, they failed the Lord, and they proved to have negative volition, would not trust the Lord. And so God said, okay, you're not getting in the land. You have lost your inheritance. You're not going to see it. I'll start working on your kids. I'll start teaching them the things that you failed to learn, and they'll get it, and they'll go in, and they'll take the land, but you've lost it. You forfeited it. You've sinned away your day of grace, okay? It's gone. But God did not stop providing for the people in the wilderness, right? He continued to meet their needs. There was still food to eat every day. There was still water to drink. Their clothes didn't wear out. God's presence was still there. The pillar of cloud by day, the pillar of fire by night. Logistical grace. God continued to provide for them, even though they were in a constant state of rebellion and negative volition. And I think that's true for Saul. God raises him up, puts him in the place of kingship. Saul proved to be disobedient on multiple occasions. God finally just said, okay, you've missed your opportunity here. I'm going to choose the next man. But there's an overlap because David, from the time he's anointed to be king of Israel, he doesn't immediately come upon the throne. He has to wait for the Lord to remove Saul. But during this time, David is learning valuable lessons. He's out in the wilderness and he's learning to trust in the Lord day by day. He's learning to trust in God's provision. He's learning that God will meet his needs. And what does Philippians tell us, right? That where Paul says that my God shall meet all of our, what? All of our needs, not all of our greeds. And what are our basic needs, right? We think of food, shelter, clothing. Paul says with these things we shall be what? Content. And we sometimes like to put a lot of other things on there. And so David's needs were being met. He's out in the wilderness. He's fleeing. This is a time for him to develop his character, to learn fighting strategies with his men, to develop a bond of a relationship with them. In other words, that furnace of affliction that David was experiencing was all part of God's plan to develop him into the man that God wanted him to be, so that when God finally did remove Saul from the throne and David comes up and he takes that position, he is now mature enough. He now has a healthy walk with God, and he knows to look to God and to trust in God in all things. And he had certain qualities about him that could not have been learned by any other means. And God used that suffering, that time of trial, again, to develop those characteristics in David. And so, but God is here judging Saul. And even though Saul hates David and Saul wants to kill David, David is not going to retaliate. David is going to follow the Lord's will. He's going to do what the Lord wants him to do. And so David takes the high road. He takes the noble road. He takes the right road. And so, but the point is that sometimes there will be people in our lives that we will come into contact with, and this is all part of our training, I believe, where God will put people in our lives that are influenced by demons. And they may be under divine discipline, and they're going to come after you. And this can occur in a number of different places. And we've already talked about this. In fact, we talked about it last week when we hit into Acts chapter 16. Because remember, when Paul was at Philippi, there was a girl there, a young girl, who was demon-possessed. And she became an annoyance to Paul, right? She was following him around. She was annoying him. She was coming after him day after day. Saul's walking through the city, and she would just keep coming along, saying, "Oh, these are servants of the Most High God. These are servants of the Most High God." And what she was saying was true. But nonetheless, it became an annoyance to Saul. And then Paul turned around and in that state of annoyance, rebuked the girl and cast the demon out. And then all of a sudden, everything breaks loose. Right now, now the owners realize that their means of making money is gone, and they form a riot and they drive Paul out of the city, and this big riot occurs. And so it makes you wonder if there was some strategy there, that maybe Paul didn't handle the situation as well as he should have, that he reacted rather than responded. And to that degree, he may have alleviated the moment of conflict, but then it erupted into something much bigger. So it's hard to be dogmatic on that, but anyway, just kind of gets you thinking about it. But the point is that there are people that are influenced by demons that will, in fact, come after God's people and will serve to be an annoyance, trying to get under your skin. So let's look at another example where God used an evil spirit, a deceiving spirit. And this one comes from 2 Chronicles 18, where King Ahab refused to obey the Lord, and God used a deceiving spirit through the mouth of Ahab's false prophets to bring about his fall. Micaiah, if you remember, was a true prophet, and he's standing before the king of Israel, Ahab, and he's standing before the king of Judah. And Micaiah gives this this heavenly scene where it says, Micaiah said, "Therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing on his right and on his left." The host of heaven, this would be the angelic host. "And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab, king of Israel, to go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said this, while another said that." So there was some discussion going on, and we're not given the particulars. "But then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said, how? And he said, I, singular, will go forth and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all his prophets," plural. Now that has puzzled me on many occasions, because how does one spirit transmit himself into the mouth of many prophets, plural? You think the flip side of that, remember back in Matthew 8 where you had Jesus meets the demon possessment at the Gadarenes, and you have a multitude, you have a legion of demons, as it were, who possess a person. Well, how do you get that many demons into the space of one person? I mean, what's the physics of that? You know, again, you don't know. But here you have the opposite. You have one evil spirit that is going to be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of Ahab's prophets, plural. And so, you know, again, we're not quite sure how that works. But that's what he says, that I will go and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all of his prophets. And his prophets would have been his trusted advisors, the men that Ahab would have gone to for counsel with regard for, you know, what do I do in this situation? Do I go into battle? Do I not go into battle? And the answer from these false prophets were, go into battle. And so this deceiving spirit was going to be in the mouth of these false prophets to persuade the king to go into this military campaign. Then he said, you are to entice him and prevail. In other words, you are to succeed. Go and do so. Now, therefore, behold the Lord, and here he's talking, here this is Micaiah again talking to Ahab. Behold, the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of these your prophets, for the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you. The Lord has proclaimed disaster against you. Now, King Ahab, we know from the text that he ignored the words of spoken by Micaiah, God's prophet, and he believed his false prophets and went into battle against Ramoth-Gilead. And you can read about that in 2 Chronicles 18. What's interesting is God controlled the details of the battle and used an unnamed soldier to kill Ahab. So Ahab goes into battle, and what happens is he actually disguises himself. He's not wearing kingly attire. He tries to disguise himself so that he's not identified on the battlefield. But towards the end of 2 Chronicles 18, we have this account here where it says, a certain man, we don't even know who, he's not named, it just says, a certain man drew his bow at random and struck the king of Israel in a joint of the armor. Well, that's what you call providence. Because this man draws back and he releases his arrow, and that arrow transmits, goes through the airway, and God determines the exact destination of that arrow. And it hits Ahab at just a point in his armor that it's a weak spot, and it penetrates into his body. And so here you have this guy that just draws his bow at random, and he struck the king of Israel in a joint of the armor. So the king said to the driver of his chariot, turn around and take me out of the fight, for I am severely wounded. And the battle raged that day, and the king of Israel propped himself up in his chariot in front of the Arameans until the evening, and at sunset, he died. God brought about the end of Ahab. He brought about his death. Part of that was orchestrated by a deceiving spirit that functioned through the mouths of his false prophets who counseled him to go into battle. Again, you see the exchange between the spirit realm, between the unseen realm, and the world in which we live. Again, we don't know all the particulars. These examples that I'm providing here, like with the last hour with Daniel 10, or this section with Micaiah, or if you're talking about Saul, these are, again, are just glimpses where we are given the divine side of the issue, where God tells us. And it's just like the passage in 2 Kings 6, where you have this army that comes against Elisha. And the servant says, what are we going to do? And God says, hey, those who are with us are more than those who are against us. And then he prays, open your eyes. And he opens and he sees the mountains full of chariots of fire. Again, an angelic army. But apart from God, again, pulling back the curtain and giving that glimpse into that spiritual realm and helping us to understand what's going on there, we would not have this information. So again, it's just designed to just, as it were, give us several examples that, again, we can pull back and we can see what's going on there. And we can understand how God is operating, even with regard to fallen angels. Now, I've gone through and I've picked a few passages here that have clearly demonstrated God's sovereignty either to permit a fallen angel, Satan, to interact with his people, or whether God sent the evil spirit, like between Abimelech and the men of Shechem. Like the spirit that got sent against King Saul that resulted in his mental breakdown. He didn't need a counselor. That would not have served, that would not have helped him. He needed to get his life right with God. That would have brought the psychosis to an end. And so we have these examples here. And then with Ahab bringing that about. So again, these are just a few examples of what is going on there in the invisible realm. And God's sovereignty always on display. Always on display. So here in this section, we observe how a deceiving spirit was used to affect the life of a national ruler which resulted in his defeat and death. By the way, we have to realize, if this was true historically, if this was true with Saul, if it was true with a leader like Abimelech, if it was true with a leader like Ahab, okay, if it was true with people functioning at this level, don't you know that it's true now? That world rulers now are no different? That they are targets by demonic forces? That if they turn away from God, they put themselves in a very vulnerable spot? And if you try... Huh? Yeah, and so you look at some of the behavior that comes out from these rulers, and you have to realize what forces are driving that, and how there's an attempt to try to change the very culture that we live in. And there is a battle raging. There is no doubt a battle raging. And for us, we have to realize that the battle is not political. The battle is not social. The battle is not cultural. The battle is spiritual. And there is a way to approach that. And we've talked about this before, and we'll hit some of it again. But so again, here we observe how a deceiving spirit was used to affect the life of a national ruler, which resulted in his defeat and death. It also demonstrates that God, that nothing gets past God. And we sometimes look at these rulers and we're like, oh, they're getting away with all this horrible stuff. Not really. God sees, God knows, and God's involved. And if we pray, He'll hear, He'll answer. And I believe that, you know, God will judge in His time and His way. I do find it interesting, the case with Abimelech, from the time he committed the crime of murdering his 70 brothers, it wasn't until 3 years later that God administered justice. And we sometimes look at that and we think, well, why the delay? And again, it could just be a display of God's grace, that He's permitting him time, you know, to come around, to turn. And then again, when He has sinned away His day of grace, so to say, then judgment comes. I mean, it's certainly true for the Amorites. I mean, they were given 400 years of grace before God finally sent the Israelites into the land to judge them. So when we see these delays in judgment, we see people getting what looks to us like they're getting away with stuff. Really, from the Supreme Court of Heaven, from the throne of Heaven, that's really not true. God sees and He knows, and He's acting. Another example, later in the book of Revelation, we learn about demons that will influence world rulers to gather them together for battle against Christ at His second coming. John wrote in Revelation 16, verse 13 and 14, he says, "And I saw coming out of the mouth of the dragon, and out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, three unclean spirits like frogs, for they are spirits of demons," or spirits which are demons. "And not only that, but they are performing signs." So they're able to do some form of miraculous signs. They're able to do something that apparently gets the attention of these kings. So they're performing signs which go out to the kings of the whole world. Isn't that interesting? We talk about how Satan has deceived the nations. And three times in the Gospel of John, Jesus referred to Satan as the ruler of this world. Now, he's been judged, and his sentence is coming. In fact, he's going to be at the end of the tribulation. We know he's thrown into the lake of fire. He's locked up in the abyss. He's locked up in prison for 1,000 years. And at the end of the 1,000 years, is he reformed? He's just as bad as when he went in. And so he gets out, and he still wants to he still deceives the nations. He goes right back to his old ways, because some people are just that way. But nonetheless, these demons go out to the kings of the whole world. Why? To gather them together for the war of the great day of God the Almighty. So they gather them together for the battle of Armageddon. So these demons have this influence over the kings of the earth. And we assume that these are all unbelieving kings who are hostile to God and who, when given the opportunity to gather their forces together, to marshal their forces in opposition and to think that somehow they can stand against Christ at his second coming, which is a form of spiritual insanity. But nonetheless, there it is. But it shows that there's demonic influence behind that activity. In closing, in these examples, we witness God's sovereign control over evil spirits. In some instances, God permits demons or evil spirits to act. In other cases, he limits their actions. And in some cases, he uses them as tools of his judgment. As tools of his judgment. And by the way, we've talked about this before, God even uses even unbelievers to accomplish his will. And of course, we think of no greater example of that than what is presented in Acts chapter 2 with regard to the crucifixion of Christ. Remember in John chapter 19, verses 10 and 11, when Jesus was standing before Pilate, and Pilate posed the question to him, he said, "Do you not know that I have authority to crucify you and I have authority to set you free?" And Jesus, what was the response that came back? "No, you don't. You would have no authority over me unless it had been given to you from above." But when you look at Acts 2, verses 22 and 23 and 24, we have a very interesting statement here. It says, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God." Stop. This man, Jesus, was delivered over to be crucified, was delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. Who sent Jesus to the cross? God did. But read the last part of the verse. "You nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death." Who put Jesus upon the cross? These godless men. And Peter puts the blame strictly upon them. He says, you did it. But God did it. Well, which is it? The answer is yes. It's both. In fact, over in Acts chapter 4, verse 27 and 28, it's brought together for us. In Acts 4:27, it says, "For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant." This is a prayer to God. They're praying to God. And the comment is made that "there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed." And who was gathered against him? Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel. Notice verse 28. "To do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur." So God used the sinful actions of these men to put Christ upon the cross. The very thing that God wanted to happen so that he would die for our sins. And their sins as well. But the point is that you have the coalescence of divine and human will here ultimately to accomplish God's ultimate purposes. And so, you know, that's true of men, but it's also true in the angelic realm as well, that you have these references to these demons, these deceiving spirits, these evil spirits, these fallen spirits, these demons, different terms, but all referring to the same group, that are free, but nonetheless God is either permitting their activity or directing their activity ultimately to accomplish his greater purposes. So again, it just demonstrates the sovereignty of God over all of these events. And it's an interesting subject.